good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line right now from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, the one, the only, John Loeffler. Hi, John.
Hello, Stan. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing just fine. How about you?
Doing well. I should point out you're not on the air up in the Northwest
I'm
right
not.
Now.
Let me find out.
Yeah, so you need to do what you need to do there. But we can talk anyway because we have people listening in Monterey.
Well, we should be in just a moment. I was just a moment ago, and somebody must have cut us off. But, you know, they'll stop nothing to keep your information off the air from getting...
No, it's country. Nothing.
No, we're on Clear Channel, and basically, lots of exciting things are going on. Of course, we just had a wonderful and joyous Christmas, despite all the efforts of the people who control the media, who control our government, who control television and... movie outlets to play down the significance of what the season is really all about. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I think this is the one year that I think more than any other year I have seen. This Christmas has been so secularized, even in dialing around to different radio stations and things. All it was reindeer and Santa Claus. It was very little religious of any other kind. And I noticed that for the first time. I said, you know, we really have outdone ourselves this time in trying to secularize the whole holiday. And the whole funny part of the thing is, you know, if you had started out 40 years ago and said, hey, all these guys, their goal is to get Christianity out of the mainline culture, yada, 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 they go, oh, well, that's conspiracy theory. That's an idiot. And that's what they said they were going to do. Remember John Dewey, all the way back to his group, they were going to take over the school system and introduce secular humanism to supplant Christianity. That was their goal and their thing, and they've actually succeeded in doing that, Dr. Stan.
Well, I think they have, and I think that you and I, and at least the people who listen to our programs, should be able to very easily to see this. I think the rest of the people are unaware of it because it's happened so subtly, so gradually, so, you know, without any shock at all, just a little each year. And this year, of course, the most widely watched program, or one of the most widely watched programs, you know, on television is ER. And last week, a week before Christmas, they had the worst down program you ever saw. You know, just felt, I mean, it had nothing to do with Christmas. It had, well, I think they had some fellow with a Santa Claus suit in one scene, but it all was about, you know, one of the heroes, the fellow who comes from the Balkans, and he makes a couple of mistakes and a couple of people die, and he is just so depressed, and he gets into his car and racks it up and seriously injures this young lady who's with him. I mean, that was the Christmas program, because the one they had on Christmas Day was even worse than that. And what they do is simply remove any mention of Christmas at all. And so many of the programs they're putting on are not happy or give you this uplift, but give you sort of a feeling of hopelessness, like no good deed will ever go unpunished. Life is simply a quiet desperation. All of these ideas that they're implanting in our minds, that this is not a time for joyous, this is not a time to celebrate the birth of our Savior. Holidays really aren't so good after all.
Yeah, and it's... But, you know, I always say darkness is a great light, place for light to shine. I have finally reconciled after looking through this year, because this has been a year of really tremendous changes. We've been talking, you and I, about going through a major paradigm shift ever since the Oslo peace process collapsed in August, September of 2000. We began into this major paradigm shift. And they're absolutely breathtaking. There have been some highlights and some lowlights. One of the highlights, of course, what I thought was the Supreme Court decision saying you couldn't arrest U.S. citizens and hold them indefinitely without charging them and bringing them to trial, and they don't forfeit their constitutional. By the way, I use the word rights. Everybody else says liberties now. Liberty sort of implies something that the state has granted, a sort of a little thing we get away with type of thing, as opposed to a constitutional right, which means no one has the right to take it from us. That's sort of the difference between the two. So there have been some highlights, but I'm not sure, I'm beginning to see, Dr. Stan, a lot of people understand that something has gone radically wrong, but most of them, for lack of sort of formal training or watching the direction that it's going in, don't seem to be able to grapple the whole thing. Now, when you explain it to them, sometimes this little light goes on in your head. They suddenly realize, oh, I knew something was going on, whether it's in the schools or whether it's in the job place or in a public meeting. People are beginning to catch on, and what we're coming to is what, you know, to quote, I think Teilhard de Chardin once talked about an omega point. And if you look, there are all sorts of parallel trends which are seemingly non-interactive right now, and they are all moving towards a common collision point at some point in the not-far-distant future. Let me give you an example. The move now towards assisted suicide and the future inability within less than 10 years of the Social Security system to begin to make payments. Now, we've been telling people that for 40 years that human life really isn't worth very much. So they won't say that at the political level, and of course we have great truck about human rights. We always hear about that. But in reality, when you tell people they come from slime, they go to slime. And moreover than that, there are no absolute values and good is a floating issue. Well, at that point, we've basically made everything a very relative, very shifting and changing definition. And once those definitions change, historically, they always change in a negative direction, and they always take with it the most defenseless of the culture first. And so we saw that in abortion. Remember how we've progressed. When abortion first came along, it was just first trimester. It was a blob of tissue. It wasn't human. Now, if you had shown someone a partial birth abortion back at that time, even the people proposing abortion would have been horrified. But now we really don't think anything about partially delivering a baby and sucking its brains out. I mean, it's really amazing that people just don't think anything of it. So if we have this lackluster care of life on one side, and now we're moving towards assisted suicide, which ultimately becomes assisted euthanasia. It's a very quick slip and just a few differences in legal formalities before we cross the bridge right now, to the point where even in countries like Holland, a lot of elderly people are afraid to go to hospitals because they don't view the doctors anymore as servants of life. They view them as both dispensers of both life and death, as judges over life and death. And that's a radical change even in your own profession. So look at what happens when we arrive 10 years from now, where the younger people coming up who have been told that they are the future, you and I are still above room temperature, Dr. Stan, but apparently we're not the future anymore. And they're told that the young are the future, that the old have really nothing to offer, and that, by the way, the young people are going to have to fork over a good 50-60% of their payroll to keep Social Security going. What do you think is going to look more attractive to this generation? See, these are what I call parallel running but combining trends. And right. So it's very easy to see. Well, we'll do a Logan's Run type of situation, is we will begin to value people on what we call quality of life judgments. Now, in the Judeo-Christian mold, life was precious at every point and had to be preserved where it could. Not of saying absurd efforts to keep life afloat, because we all know we all die at some point. Now we have quality of life judgments and relative judgments, and who determines what that quality is going to be? And what are the references and the baselines that they use to determine it? So you see, we put ourselves on a very horrible slope. It's nothing new, by the way. This type of thing, I've just been reading, fascinating. This is the 200th anniversary of the beginning of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And Lewis and Clark went through just south of where I am right now, down the Clearwater River. And one of the things that Lewis noted in his diary was the fact that Native Americans, you know, were always told that Native Americans lived in blissful harmony with nature, but in reality, in many of the tribes that existed that they encountered, when the elderly got too elderly, they were just put out to pasture, literally put out in the wilderness with a bowl of food and a bowl of water, and said, that's it, you've lived your life, you're not useful to the tribe, you need to move on to the ancestors and get on with it. So this is nothing new. And once we jettison the values, Christianity rescued much of the world from darkness in its time. And now the world is just intent on going back to it. Doesn't mean we have to be down, okay, because I believe we always have a place with the Lord. That doesn't bother me. But it does demand that we recognize what that will mean. And there's a cause for action here. If you remember back in the time of the Roman Empire, the Romans used to abandon babies they didn't want, largely girls, by the way, and they would take them out and expose them and leave them to die. And the Christians began going around seeing the potential for souls for Christ, and they would rescue these babies and take them in and adopt them and feed them. So in every place of darkness, there's always a place to shine. But you do have to recognize we're heading into a battle in a time of darkness.
Well, I think one of the big problems is that the average Christian doesn't realize that there's a battle between light and darkness. They don't understand the battle between God and Lucifer, the prince of this world, that's being waged today because they don't talk about it in their churches. The average individual finds it very difficult to believe that there really could be men and women in this world today who have given themselves over to the dark side, knowingly or unknowingly, are carrying out Lucifer's wishes and Lucifer's goals. Until people recognize there's a spiritual battle going on, well, they're not going to understand anything that's going on today. And that some of the people who are involved have intentionally gone over to the other side. I got an email just the other day from a woman who was very incensed at me for a television program I'd done, and she announced that she was a witch. And she said, there are lots of us out here are witches, and, you know, but we're good people, and most witches are good witches, and, you know, that we just sort of get this power, we tap into this power from this other world, but we can use that power for good purposes. And, of course, what she doesn't realize is she's tapping into the power, the supernatural power of the Lord of this world. And the average individual, you talk to them about this sort of thing, they look at you as if you're from another planet. I mean, you wonder how some water witchers can really find water when a hydrologist can't, because they tap into this other worldly knowledge. And, of course, we're told in the Bible to be really to avoid water divining. Why? Because, you know, over 2,000 years ago, they recognized that the power of the diviner came from the dark side. It's just that 2,000 years later, people aren't as smart as they were 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, people are exactly the same as they were 2,000 years ago. You know, it's interesting you mention that, because if you remember, that was a key theme in The Lord of the Rings, and that the race of man always kept insisting they would put the ring to work for good purposes. And the message that always had to be resounded is, no, you can't use a source of evil power for good purposes. It will sooner or later take you over. And that's a hard sell. You know, the other thing is, we talk about who are good people. It's interesting. I read an excellent article by one of the gentlemen from the Discovery Institute in Seattle on this whole problem of evil, etc. Well, who defines what evil and good are? One of the questions that you always hear say as an argument against intelligent design is that, look at all the evil in the world. If there's so much evil, you have to assume then that was designed by God, and therefore God isn't good, and therefore you can't have a good God, etc., etc. But what they forget is, right in the very seeds of the argument they're making are the seeds of its own destruction as well. Because if you take God out of the picture, then who is to say what is good and what is evil? Nobody can seem to agree on that. And even if they can agree on certain things as being evil, how do you agree on what it is you should do to take care of that evil, that type of thing? So when people say, well, we're good, we just do this, well, according to whose definition are you good? As Francis Schaeffer once said, if there is no God, then whatever is right. And so we need God in the picture. We can't take God out of this picture. Because as soon as you do, then everyone just makes it up as he or she wants. And that's what you're seeing happening right now. I remember Sam Hayakawa many, many years ago, back in the late 60s, when he was president of San Francisco State University, and he decided to put a stop to a lot of the nonsense that was going on during the riots. He took a very courageous stand in the midst of all of the nonsense that was going on between 1968 and 1970. But he made a comment. He said, in a society where anything goes, nothing goes. There has to be some organization, there has to be some definition. So when someone protests to you, well, we're good, we're doing this, well, okay, how do you know it's good? Well, we help people. Well, how do you know that's good? Maybe since there are too many people on the earth, we should just let maybe half of us die. There are some people who would actually, I mean, today in the radical environmentalism movement, think that letting X number of people die would be a good idea because we're a cancer on the face of the earth.
So what you're saying is there has to be a standard, and it's not a standard that we set, because if we say that it won't be a good standard, it has to be God's standard.
Right. If you or I said it, somebody can always come along and challenge it, right? you need some form of an external standard, otherwise it just doesn't hold together for very long.
And that's why, of course, they're so down on the Ten Commandments. That's why they've got to do away with any public display of the Ten Commandments, because we can't have let people know that there are standards. We can't have our children knowing. In fact, I'm sure you know that wonderful decision by our United States Supreme Court taking the Ten Commandments out of the schools. And the justification was this. It wouldn't do any good to have them in schools unless the children read them. If the children read them, they might meditate upon them. If they meditated upon them, they might obey them. And if the children of the schools of the United States were to obey the Ten Commandments, that would be a violation of the wall of separation between church and state. Now, imagine, carry that the next step forward, that we should not tell our young children that thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not lie or bear false witness. That is what the Supreme Court, in essence, said. And where was the church? The church was deafening in its silence. The church wouldn't take a stand on that or anything else of any significance.
Right, well, and that's a very important question that you just brought up, because let's go back all the way to the first decision about prayer in school and that type of thing. The Christians went along with that, and they said, well, the Supreme Court has said that we shouldn't do this, that this violates the war of separation of church and state.
No, that's the law of the land, and we have to obey the law after
right,
all.
Right, okay, so let's assume that we go along with that one, okay, back then. What was the very next thing that the church should have been doing? The very first time that some other value, see, you have to ask the question, okay, well, are you going to teach any values in the school system? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, then the question is, whose values are you going to teach? And they never got to that far. So the very first time that we had traits of other religions brought into schools, and there are just hundreds of examples of this, the Christians should have been there with lawsuits all over the place. He's making it a level playing field. See, it's fine. If you want to say we have a wall of separation of church and state, that's fine. But if we can't bring ours in, you can't bring yours in. I remember I got a call from a parent in Washington State one time who was real concerned because one of the teachers in one of the grade schools every day was reading the horoscopes to the children in class. And so a number of the Christian parents got concerned, and they went down. They said, well, you know, we're concerned about this, and we'd like you to read some passages from the Word for today here. She said, oh, I can't do that because that's religion. And they said, well, so is reading their horoscope. And she said, oh, no, that's fun. You see, so we have a double standard going on here. And that's where the church fell down. Rather than insisting that, no, if we're going to say no religion in the schools, we mean no religion, not Native American, not Buddhist, not you name it, it doesn't come into the schools. But that's where we failed. You notice the ACLU never launches any lawsuits when those are involved.
Well, of course, the whole idea of values clarification, which is being taught in classrooms all across America. And, of course, the idea, well, we have to clarify your values. I mean, how do we determine what's right and wrong? Well, imagine you're in a lifeboat, and they love that lifeboat story. You know, there's only room for 6 people, and there are 10 people, and you're going to have to throw 4 overboard. And so who are you going to throw? The old person, the old minister who's 80 years old, sort of doddering, the young pregnant woman, you know, the little child, the elderly, grumpy old man, you know, which one are you going to determine they're going to have? Because you're going to have to make that decision. And once you start putting decisions onto children to make a life and death decisions with no moral standards from elsewhere, you're laying the foundation for moral anarchy, and that's what we have in America today. And what was being taught in our schools, and is still being taught in our schools, is the very dictum of Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, who said, do what thou wilt, that is the whole of the law. You do whatever you want to, you determine what's right and wrong. And society cannot exist under those circumstances, and that's why we're in the trouble we are today.
Yeah, look at everything that's been written about Columbine High School. Go ahead and you do your break and we'll come back.
Oh, no, you got the 30 seconds.
Well, in Columbine High School, remember, they were one of the schools that pioneered death education and values clarification. So when Klebold and his partners show up and shoot up the school, everyone's horrified. We have hundreds of psychologists descend upon the school and this and that. But the problem was, this was the value system that you taught. They simply clarify their values, Dr. Stan. So why is everybody upset just because some people died?
We'll be right back here in just a few moments here at Radio Liberty, and we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our special guest this evening is John Leffler, who on Steel on Steel, and of course John is one of my favorite guests, and I'm sure he is yours as well. John, why don't you tell our listeners here in the Monterey Bay Area how they can get in touch with you and get your programs, because I think that these are some of the finest programs we have available in our country today. So how can people hear your programs and know what you're putting out?
Well, Archie, where everybody's meeting right now, I mean listening right now, you can either hear the program, of course, on KFER, and up in the Northwest, you can hear it on the American Christian Network on KTRW on Sundays at noon. Or you can go onto the Internet at steelonsteel.com. We have the programs archived there back 12 weeks, so you have a chance to hear them, and there's a descriptor there showing who the guests are and what the subject of conversation is. And we started doing the show about 15 years ago. I started into broadcasting in 1965, and finally we decided in 1990 someone better get on the air and begin telling people what is exactly being twisted out of reality by the media, as we say, by ignorance, bias, or neglect. So that's the way they can do it. They can order tape subscriptions online, or they can actually just listen online, take out an online subscription as well.
All right.
By the way, I figured out, do you know why the real reason that they don't want the Ten Commandments posted in the state capitals, especially in the legislatures, with the commandments, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not lie, and things of that nature? It creates a hostile working environment for politicians. So that's basically why you don't want it.
Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Spokane. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and thank you for the show. I'm really enjoying it. I think it's very important information to get out there, that there's been such a significant change in our society that it borders on just a fundamentalism of a different kind that we haven't, recognized. And it's designed to undo our religious underpinning.
Absolutely. And because I love a wonderful statement by Whitaker Chambers, human societies, like human beings, live by faith and die when faith dies. In other words, destroy the faith, you destroy this society, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I heard it said once, it said daycare today, euthanasia tomorrow. And I thought it was very salient. The idea is that, if you're so busy materialistically following after the things of this world, that you're not caring for your children, and they miss the model of a nurturing family environment. They grow up with the idea, through the school systems of, as we were speaking of earlier, values clarification, and that you decide your own destiny. And you grow up and you realize that your parents now are helpless and don't really provide you with anything. They're simply viewed as excess. And, what do you do with excess? It's a very difficult time.
Okay, do you have a question for our special guest tonight?
It had to do with the idea of getting religious and moral training back into the school. You see, the demographics, I am 45 years old, 46 years old. In 1958 was the year that prayer was taken out of school. I was the first generation of human beings in this country to go through school where you didn't pray in school. And I realized, I'm a Christian and a believer, meant by the grace of God, but I know that the demographics, if somebody did a reasonably good job of chasing that out, would prove the day of that decision, tripled all these certain, difficult children in school environments, beatings, violence, and all sorts of demographic
information. Hold that thought for just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got Mike calling us from Spokane, and he's pointing out that he is in the first generation that were to be raised without prayer in school. And although he himself is a Christian, he feels there's a definite causal relationship between taking God out of school and the progressive moral breakdown of our society. And he's saying if somebody were to check that out, they would probably be able to document that. And of course, actually, David Barton has done that beautifully in his book, The Obstruction of the Original Intent. In that book, which we do carry, he simply shows the dramatic increase in all of the bad things in America and going right back to that prayer decision in 1962. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Well, there was a critical period between about 1962 and later in the decade. I'd say about a 5-year window in there because during that time you had the prayer decision in schools, you had Roe v. Wade, which opened the door on the abortion. Right about the same time, in the late 50s and really revving up into the 60s, they began the first experimentation with children in the public school systems. Maslow, Rogers, they turned the schools into psychological laboratories and actually stated that the goal was to get children to reject the values of their parents, to move away and to think their own values. Theoretically, they were making the children open-minded. In reality, what they were doing were programming the children in a whole new set of, at the time, what was called secular humanist values. And whether, you know, even today, you look at teachers in the school, I run into Christian teachers in the public school system, and what I've really noticed, the impression I've gotten in talking with them around the country, is they haven't figured out that there's a problem. And I sat and kept trying to think of, you know, you can't solve a problem, Dr. Stan, until you recognize what the problem is. And in talking with them, I've suddenly realized that there are very few teachers left in the school system. They were called defective teachers, by the way, by the progressive educators. There are very few of those defective teachers, so to speak, left, who remember what a classic didactic education was all about. They have been systematically weeded out or allowed to retire so that the newer system can be brought in. So any teacher that goes in through teacher training now is going in literally through a brainwashing process. There is a book I have sitting right here, as a matter of fact. It's not in print anymore, called Human Relations and Curriculum Change. It came out in 1949. And it was a compendium. It almost became the Bible of teacher training on how to literally cook teachers. It was a cookbook for how to cook teachers or teacher candidates as they came through the system to reshape their thinking to match the new secular humanist standards. That's why if we say, how do you reintroduce this in schools, you don't. This is now beyond recoverability. Right. What you have to do is you have to start alternative systems and whereby children are educated in the new system. And people will say, well, some schools are better than others. And I go, yeah, that's sort of like saying the A deck was better than the C deck on the Titanic. One's just a little closer to the water than the other, but they're all on the same slide. Why? Because they're all using the same curricula. All of the curricula are rigged to be highly attitudinal in nature. Look at the NAEP test. When you come to a NAEP test, about 50% test for your students' attitudes, values, and beliefs. Through a very sophisticated series of testing. So that's why we have trouble today, and that's why it is impossible. I tell people, you just absolutely cannot send kids into various buzzsaws and then expect them to come out with sort of their worldview intact, because you are having a worldview collision. Other people will say, well, we should put our kids in that school system because they can be salt and light. They are not there to be salt and light. It says, raise up a child in the way he should go, and later on he will not depart from it. All right. In the formation stage, many of the children do not have enough personality integration to be able to handle the kind of pressure. And a lot of times, you know, it depends on the kind of teacher you have. Some teachers are friendly towards us. Others are hostile to Christianity. And they make that quite clear in the various ways they handle children from Christian families or from other religions, for that matter, if the teachers tend to be atheistic. So it's a giant mixed bag. And as a result of that, you have to really ask yourself, how are you as a parent going to handle this situation? But to think about taking it back, you can't, because nobody shares a common worldview anymore. Okay. We do not, if there's one thing we have done, Dr. Stan, it is the secular humanist crowd, when they came in, John Dewey and his successors, successfully dynamited the fabric of the culture. And now we have fragments and broken brackets all over the place, and now we're told we're a multicultural society. Wonder how we got to be a multicultural society, because to go back to Dr. Sam Hayakawa at San Francisco State, in a society where anything goes, nothing goes.
Amen to that. Well, Mike, did you have anything else you wanted to say? If you did,
no, I didn't. I thank you for the answer, and we just need to take it back the way they did it.
Amen to that.
And persistence and faith.
God bless you.
God bless you.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, we're going to have to take another little break here, and then when we get back, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But remember that there's no way, in my estimation, a child stands at any chance at all in the government schools. They're going after his mind, heart, and soul. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you're out there listening to us, we do hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family, because this is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, and bringing people the information they're not going to get from other sources. So if you believe, as I do, that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, economic, educational, financial battlefield, we do hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family. And it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And the other thing that you can do, of course, is to tell others about our programs, to tell them about our website at RadioLiberty.com, and encourage them to go to that website and get the information that they need so that they can act effectively in times like this. They can listen to the radio 5 hours a day, a live programming. They can go to the archives for another 5 hours a day. And, of course, they won't get anything at all accomplished, but they'll certainly get a lot of great information. And it's well worthwhile even listening to some programs, like the one we're doing tonight with our good friend John Leffler, several times to get the various thoughts that are here. Because sometimes I know very well that I listen to tapes sometimes two or three times, and I learn something each time. Well, our job is to become informed ourselves so that we can inform others and get the information out, get people to realize there's a problem, and then recruit them into this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure. Because this is really what it's all about. America was a nation under God. It was the first nation wherever the people proclaim that freedom came from God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal and were endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which were life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that governments were instituted among men to preserve these rights, deriving their authority from the consent of the governed. That's what America was all about. We were a nation under God, and that's where our freedoms come from, unlike any other nation in the world. And for many years, why, America was a Christian nation. 50 years ago, everybody knew America was a Christian nation. No longer do they know that, of course. It's simply been removed. The people who control the media, the people who control the motion pictures and television, the people who control the publishing industry, they've simply removed this knowledge of God. Oh, yes, there are some Christian publishers out there. But you'd be amazed at how many of these Christian publishers are owned by non-Christians, like Zondervan, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And I don't think anybody would ever accuse him of being an evangelical Christian. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our special guest this evening is John Leffler, and we've just been talking a little bit about our ministry. And so, John, as we see what's going on today, we see the situation where really the child doesn't stand a chance going to school. I mean, he's not put in a position where he can debate his teachers. The teacher is an authority figure, and as the teacher undermines his belief in God and family and country, that poor child is put into a horrible position, and this is done year after year after year. And so, really, what can we do? How can we approach even the problem of education with any hope of creating a generation of young people who believe in God, who believe in family, who believe in the importance of preservation of this once great and noble heritage of faith that we inherited from generations past?
Yeah, it is sort of interesting, isn't it, that the belief system, which was the core of the country 40 years ago, has now come to be called extremist by the people who are leading us forward into the great relativist vacuum that they know not what. They don't even know where we're headed, for that matter. Well, some of them do. The biggest clarion call I can make, and I've been trying to do this for 15 years by pointing out that everything is interconnected, politics, religion, where we're going, worldviews, and the quality of the life that we have and respect for it. The clarion call that I make is to the churches to start with. You have to understand what the nature of the battle is. And it's a worldview battle. It always has been. Francis Schaeffer made that call 20 to 25 years ago, and large parts of the church ignored him. But there are a few that have come back, and we say this is it. Because every time the church has run into this issue in history, it has to sort of circle the wagons and determine what is and what is not legitimate Christian thought. And there are two processes to the problem of education. Number one are the things that are being taught in education. In other words, what is true and not true, et cetera. But number two, the process of thought that is being taught. And no one thinks about that. That's a little more transparent to most people. In other words, if you're taught to think didactically in logical categories, or if you're taught to have this so-called open mind, which really in this case is an open sieve, which says we should accept anything, but it really doesn't accept anything. It only accepts things which are in its bracket of dialecticalism. So those are the things that are there. And there's a large-scale ignorance of this among pastors in the churches, and they have to come to grips with that first of all, to begin building backfires in the youth, that the youth can be trained in these areas to understand what they're encountering, especially youth in high school and especially those who are going away to college. Now, you would think, for the rate of loss that we've been experiencing in the church, that the alarm bells would just be ringing red. But dang, you know, the one thing I just can't seem to find, and I've been from church to church to church, Dr. Stan, is I can't find a sense of urgency among a lot of pastoral staff to begin training people in this area. Every once in a while, some pastor will contact us and say, you know, I began listening and I suddenly understood what you were trying to say and I see how critical and core it is. And that makes me feel good. But for every one that does that, there's just handfuls of them out there. And I don't know what it is they're doing. They go from Sunday to Sunday and we teach kids the Bible and all that. But, you know, teaching them the Bible in a vacuum will not do anything. You have to make them understand how it's going to be used. It's my analogy of that is it's like handing someone a great big sword. Remember the line from Zorro where Anthony Hopkins asks Antonio Banderas, do you know how to use that thing? And he says, yes. He says, the pointy end goes in the other guy. You know? So he's got the theory, but we just say, well, take this sword and swing it around wildly and maybe you'll hit something. But all that has to happen is for some atheistic professor to come along and begin undermining the basis for belief in the scriptures. And the whole thing falls down like a deck of cards. And unless someone knows how to come back at that and come back successfully, which you can do, they're vulnerable. And you will lose, your church will lose, somewhere between 50 to 80% of their youth in the 4 years of college, leading up to a bachelor's degree. You would think this would just be an emergency situation par excellence. But for some reason, churches go on. And that's because churches have lost a sense of mission as well. And they fail to understand that it isn't just an altar call that we're looking for. We're looking for the training of warriors. That's what it's all about. Train people to fight. It is a battle. It's not a physical battle in terms of picking up a weapon and slinging it. It's a battle of ideas and minds and the spiritual dimension that goes on behind it. And that's what we're not doing. What we have allowed the church to happen in the last 40 years is to be psychologized out. You remember you mentioned the Christian publishers. As a broadcaster, we get a lot of promotional books, and we look at their catalogs. They are flooded over with self-help. I mean, what's the difference between Christian books and Deepak Chopra? I can't tell. There isn't much difference at all. But the concept about duty, sacrifice, self-abnegation, fighting different fights, the pain that is involved in battle. You know, there's a pastor who wrote about the new emerging house church movements, Wolfgang Simpson, in Germany, and he said, never trust anybody who doesn't walk with a limp. Because if they don't walk with a limp, they've never been in battle, they've never been wounded. And then why are they telling you what to do? They have not a clue. So that's what we're looking at. I'm finding more and more people that I see in the churches that, first of all, it's a good portion of it is questionable whether they're Christians or not because they have no idea about their history or the Christian worldview, and the Barna polls bear this out, who in a time of trial or difficulty will go, hey, I didn't bargain for this, I'm out of here. Now, that's not the kind of person you want standing next beside you on the battlefield. You need someone with you that you know you can count and rely upon. So this is why the whole fabric of the church in the West is in grave jeopardy right now. And the only way that I have finally been able to see it is that small groups of Christians, a lot of the men, Dr. Stan, are saying, well, if the pastor won't do it, we will do it on our own. And they're taking that responsibility in hand and moving it in that direction. Because I tell you what, this society has put itself on the very same path that societies have gone before. It will shipwreck. But we don't have to, and I don't think we can necessarily get off the ship. But we can at least move ourselves to a part where we may not be hurt as badly when it does.
you know, how often I get the calls, and I'm sure you do as well, John, from people. I got a call just this afternoon from a lady from Rochester, New York, saying that she and her sister cannot find a church back there that they feel comfortable in. And, you know, what can we do? And, of course, my response was, you form a home church. Well, she said, we're women. And I said, well, if you can't get a man to form it, then you go ahead and form it yourself. The important thing is that you have a fellowship where you're worshiping the Lord together and building upon that. But this is the way I think increasingly we're going to have to go, because the church growth movement has swept Christianity, you know, more than any other thing that's ever happened. Over 350,000 church leaders, ministers, and lay leaders have been trained in the purpose-driven church. And most of them, I had a gentleman call me just today. He said, what's wrong with this system? And I said, it's all based upon manipulation. It's a psychological game that you're playing. He says, it sounds so good. And I said, sure, it sounds good. I mean, if it didn't sound good, could they sell it to you? But it's all about how we're going to manipulate the members of the church and get rid of the people who won't go along with it. Well, he said, yeah, that really is true. But
one of the things I argue, and by the way, that shows just the fact that they're asking that question shows the philosophical bankruptcy of the church today. It was what Francis Schaeffer called the great evangelical disaster. And he warned, that was what that whole book was all about. Don't adapt this dialectical process of thought. He said, or sooner or later the church will come to look like the world. He said the church will not be able to stand against the world spirit of the age if it begins to adopt the process. And that's what it has done. It has begun to adopt the same dialectical process that Lenin used, that Stalin used, that all of these Marxists use. It is a Marxist dialectical process. This was not thought up by Rick Warren. Rick Warren did not invent this purpose-driven church. He adopted these ideas from people such as Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker was walking right in the footsteps of the Leipzig and the Frankfurt School, who brought this whole dialectical process, they even refer to it as a brainwashing process.
And, of course, it was really designed for corporations and designed about how a corporation could control and manipulate the people who work for it.
Right, exactly. Same along with Tavistock and these other institutes. They're all operating in the same school, and then they were just adopted over. Now people will ask me, well, does Pastor Warren know that he did it? I said, I don't care whether he knows it or not. I don't care whether he's a wolf in sheep clothing, or badly deceived, or he's guided by money, or has a good heart, but he's just misguided. I don't care. You see, Dr. Stan, if you're ill, or if I'm ill and you come along and you have this gun, and you say, well, if I point this thing at you, you just pull the trigger here, you'll feel a lot better. Put it up to your head and do that. Now, whether you did it mistakenly or you knew exactly what you were doing, the net effect is the same, you see? And that's the problem. You have adopted poison into the system, and the poison works its way around gradually. The church growth program results in an increase of warm bodies in the church. It does not result in an increase of believers in the church. Because in order to get those warm bodies into the church, it must alter the message of Christianity to a point that they can find it palatable. And that is the bottom line of what's wrong with it.
Well, let's go to John, who's calling in from Post Falls, Idaho. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hi there. Good evening, gentlemen, and happy Boxing Day.
All right. Well, of course, for the people out there who don't know, Boxing Day is celebrated in Great Britain and Canada.
Right. It's also the Feast of Stephen, by the way, upon which good King Wenceslas went out.
Okay. Anything else other than the whelping, bidding us a good Boxing Day? Did you have a question?
I guess Happy Kwanzaa, too, right? So we got everything in
right.
there, right?
I guess
yeah.
that covers it. I did indeed. Gentlemen, I'd like to take, since the three of us are on the line, a brief survey. Both of you are very familiar with the subject. Do you basically feel, on a scale of 1 to 100%, are the aims and goals of PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, basically subversive, 100% being 100% subversive to the constitutional administration of foreign policy?
Well, that's a little off the subject, but we'll get John to your thoughts on PNAC. Is PNAC pushing a constitutional agenda, or is this a completely different agenda? And for our listeners out there who do not know what PNAC is, it is a small group of people who organized in the 1997 and published their statement of principles in June of 1997. You can pull them down from the internet at newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org, one word. And you'll find that you'll have people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and John Bolton and Paul Wolfowitz and Gary Bauer and William Bennett and Frank Gaffney and then a number of other people very powerful in the Council on Foreign Relations magazine publishers. And they set out with this idea that America would dominate the world, and one of the most first things we would do would be to go to war with Iraq. That was their stated statement in 1998. They wrote to President Clinton and said, we've got to go to war with Iraq. So the question then comes up, John, is this a constitutional agenda, or is this another agenda having nothing to do with what America should be doing?
I would say it's a non-constitutional agenda. The concept that the Constitution is important nowadays is probably one of the least regarded issues in Washington, which is driven by other ideals and idealism. And so I would say it doesn't make any difference whether you come from the left or the right. Those are all sort of chimeras nowadays. It's a non-constitutional agenda to pursue a more globalist agenda, a Pax Americana. It looks very much like Cecil Rhodes' old Anglo-American alliance. Boy, when it first came together, when Prime Minister Tony Blair showed up after 9/11, I thought, whoa, this is a change. And when they all began bad-mouthing the EU and France and Germany and things, and it was really clear that something different had come afoot. Now, as to whether everybody involved in that circuit believes that, I don't know, because at every level of any kind of a movement, there are always sort of the initiates who really have a close circle handle on what's going on, and there are those supporters who support it for various reasons or deceptions. That was true of the Communist Revolution, too, you know. And but as a whole, what we are importing into Iraq right now is not necessarily our form of government either. You know, we keep talking about democracy, and we keep talking about communitarianism. It's more communitarian type thing, rather than the style. The concept, the Republican style of government that we had is in the process of dying. It may still be on paper, but it's dying de facto, as are the Bill of Rights. Okay, as is the Bill of Rights. It's dying because of the process of end-running and ignorance. How do you, I wrote an interesting, I finally had to write an editorial to my liberal friends, because I've been reading a lot of the liberal traffic on George Bush and what the neocons have done, the PNAC crowd. And what it was, is the title of the editorial was Stop Complaining. And what I did is I showed how, while the liberals are all upset that President Bush lied about Iraq and is violating all these rights, I said, but it's been the liberal Congress of the last 30 years, until the changeover occurred in 94, that carefully paved the way to enable President Bush to do that. And I gave them just example after example of how they had end-run this Bill of Rights, and they had done this, and they said it was okay for President Clinton to lie. And I said if it was okay for President Clinton to perjure himself, then by tacit admission, it was also okay for President Bush to lie about why we needed to go into Iraq. So I said, stop complaining. You laid the pathway. You ignored the Constitution. You created judicial activism. You tortured the Bill of Rights into saying things that it never said. And you ignored those things that it did say when it said shall not be infringed. So after you've distorted it, I said, don't feel bad that the Republicans want to play with it for a while. Okay? Because when they're all done with it, then they'll be hell to pay, literally. Because hell is going to come after both of us in the mind of, remember, Thomas More in Man for All Seasons. He said, if after you've laid all of the laws flat in the name of a good deed, he said, what will stop the devil from whipping round on you and getting you once all the protections are gone? So that's the situation that we're in, is we have systematically taught people, you know, they complain about the rights being violated, but it's the same crowd that told us that those rights were created by dead white slave owners who were no longer relevant. Well, you can't have it both ways, Dr. Stan.
And that's my biggest irk with both crowds out there. And I know I'll get some calls from libertarians telling me, yeah, are you going to vote libertarian now? You know. But what they don't understand is the system has so much momentum now that it really doesn't matter too much which way you vote, to be honest with you.
All right, John, does that answer your question at all?
Well, I was looking for a numerical score. I'll just give you mine. I agree with John that there are some good-hearted people within PMAC, so I would say 70% chance that they are basically subversive. But what would you say that because it comes from the House of Crystal, that's spelled with a K, that it's somehow anti-Semitic? I don't have an anti-Semitic bone in my body. I pray for the peace of Israel every day. What would you say to those folks that say that if you oppose PNAC, you're anti-Semitic?
Well, could I just suggest that you get my latest newsletter, I think it was last month or the month before that, and I address this whole issue. This whole thing of PNAC is a fraud. In other words, they put together this organization, they put their secret plan up on the internet so everybody could read it, they put their people, I mean, we're talking about 25 people in this original organization, and you find out that they control the Bush administration. I mean, you got Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, you got John Bolton, you got Paul Wolfowitz, you got their people at every level of that. And so suddenly now we can point our finger and we say PNAC's behind everything that's going on. PNAC is simply a front group for the Anglo-American establishment. Certainly about a third of the people in PNAC happen to be Jewish, but two-thirds of them come from the Council on Foreign Relations. This is all to distract us, to get us arguing about the wrong issues. Once again, they're playing games with us, John. But let me just make the one point that the whole agenda, whether we call PNAC, whether we call it the Council on Foreign Relations, the Anglo-American Establishment, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, their whole idea right now is a Pax Americana. Well, the Romans tried that 2,000 years ago with the Pax Romana, and you know what happened to them. The whole idea of our Constitution was not to be involved with other countries. We were not out to rule the world. But this is the real goal. America is leading the whole world into this new world order and new world religion. In the process, we will end up destroying ourselves. And I'm very, very concerned that if people do not understand that behind the political is the spiritual, then we will continue losing. Anything else, John?
Very quickly, Congressman Paul said there was an absolutely constitutional way to, if the goal and aim had been to remove Saddam Hussein, we could have issued letters of mark and reprisal and set an extremely high bounty on his head. And this entire thing could have been accomplished at a far less cost, treasure, and blood. That's all I want to say.
Thank you so much, John. Well, I would simply add that you cannot look and see what's going on in Iraq unless you look at the history. And anybody who wants to question what I'm having, we have a couple of articles, one out of UPI and the other from the Washington Post, pointing out that Saddam Hussein worked for the CIA in the 1950s, that we helped him all during the 1980s, we financed him, we kept him in power, and all you have to do is read the article of the Washington Post, how we even encouraged him to move into Kuwait. That we backed him after he used these horrible weapons of chemical weapons on his own people and on the Iranians. And we gave him $5 billion to build up his war machine. And then, of course, after the Kuwait war, we allowed him to continue smuggling oil so he could finance his Republic Guard and finance his brutal bodyguards. And then whenever the Iraqi military tried to overthrow him, we actually undercut them. That's covered in a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer, which you really should get. I've never been able to get an interview with Robert Baer, but it's a great, great book. He was a CIA agent, the senior CIA agent in Iraq during the period of the 1995 period. So we put him in power, we kept him in power, we financed him in power, and now we're going to destroy him. What's wrong with this picture, John?
Now he's the great evil of Iraq, and he was. I mean, I have no doubt about that. But he's not the first of many evil dictators that we've kept in power and not done anything about. I mean,
well, I think the people who financed him should be held equally responsible. I think the people who supported him after he'd used the chemical weapons on his own people, I think that they bear the responsibility. I think the people who financed Saddam Hussein bear the responsibility for what he did, and I would believe that they should be on trial as well.
Yeah. The hardest sell to the American people is the fact that the overt agendas are not the real agendas. And I'm not sure why it is so resistive in the West to that when all of the evidence and the documentation cries out for that. But and it's the same thing you were talking about. If you watch the talk shows at night, I can only stand them for about 5 or 10 minutes anymore because they're arguing over the wrong issues. And I listened to someone interview someone from Israel and someone from Palestine today, and I'm amazed at how you can never get to the talking bubbleheads can never seem to get to the bottom of the issue, of any issue that's out there. And if we look at the Middle East issue, you know what everybody forgets about Israel? Israel is the only country whose very existence is still to this day threatened. And it is being coerced into a situation whereby it was going to have to give up security to get peace. And how does it do this? It gets guarantees. Well, let's see how well guarantees are working. Nobody's been watching too much what's going on in Zimbabwe, at least we're not here in America. In Zimbabwe, the country is in total meltdown right now. Now, it was the U.S. and Great Britain that, through their diplomatic channels, gave guarantees to the white farmers of Zimbabwe that the minority, that once black rule came in and took over, that it would be, that their rights would be guaranteed. Well, we had a Marxist guy come in, Mugabe, and the country, he's been seizing property. The story is endless. Very few people right now are watching what's going on in South Africa. You know, what the average American understands is the old myth that Nelson Mandela was a freedom fighter and spent all this time in jail to overthrow apartheid. Apartheid was pretty well on its way out before Mandela came in. Even Amnesty International did not support Mandela because of his terrorist background. In other words, he was not a prisoner of conscience because of their practice of necklacing. And they killed far more, and I have to say blacks, because remember the coloreds in South Africa are people from India and things of that nature. South Africa right now is sliding into the abyss economically and whatever. Everyone thinks that it's a fully functioning country. It's not. It's been going downhill since Mandela and Thabo Mbeki took it over. And they're trying to roll it into just total socialism right now. So that's what's, until we separate what I call evil rides in on the back of a white horse. But it's because of the way things are handled in the media. It is very difficult to get to the bottom of the issues because the real hardcore questions are not asked, and if they are on the few rare occasions, they don't hold the people's feet to the fire until they get the answer. And that's the situation we face in this country right now. You know, I can walk you down the daisy chain of the whole war on terror. And whereas I do support the troops wherever they go, because they need that, I did not believe in how the troops were spit upon coming back from Vietnam. During the time of the Vietnam War. What the hardcore question is, how did we get from Osama bin Laden to Saddam Hussein? Where did that jump occur? And the answer is, PNAC was already in the wings, that was already planned, and 9-1-1 was simply the catalyzing event that allowed it to happen. And I think, Dr. Stan, we're probably in for a few more catalyzing events, because the conversion of our country into more of a military-style country, which a lot of these elitists, I think, would like to do, has not occurred yet. And people will call me wacky, but you know, Dr. Stan, I began talking about Osama bin Laden in 1996 on my show when everybody else was going, who? You know, so just because I'm a little further ahead doesn't make me a wacko.
God love you. Thanks so much for being with us, John. Always a pleasure. Look forward to having you with us once again. Again, it has just been John Loeffler, steelonsteel.com. Go to his website and listen to his programs, join his club, and get them programs on a regular basis. Good night. God bless you, John.
God bless, Dr. Stan.
Okay. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. And, of course, right now, hold your calls. We're hoping very soon to have John Spring on the line. And John is a young man. I shouldn't say he's a young man. He's a gentleman who's a geographer, and he studied geography. He's taught geography. And, of course, most recently, he's had his own radio program on in Southern California on the Saturday evenings, or perhaps it was Sunday evenings, on a regular basis. And, unfortunately, they've sold the station out from underneath him. So perhaps this Sunday will be the last program going to be doing. Without further ado, John Spring, how are you?
Real fine, Dr. Stan.
Where do we stand as far as the program this Sunday? Is it Sunday or Saturday?
Unfortunately, Dr. Stan, I regrettably have to report that as of 12 midnight tonight, the station is going to start broadcasting in Spanish. So,
well, I don't speak very good Spanish, so I guess we'll have to put that one off till you get another station.
Yeah, I'm afraid so, Dr. Stan. I hate to be the bearer of bad news.
Well, I know how hard you've worked and built up a great audience there, and at least got some people down in the Los Angeles basin educated as to what's going on. And each of us, you know, does what we can, and I think you've done a wonderful job in a very important market. And for how long were you on? About 6 months to a year?
Well, we were on almost 10 months.
All right, well, that's great.
And we started in March.
So you got a lot of people thinking, and that's all we can hope for. And what you do and what I do and John Loeffler does and Chuck Crismeyer and certainly Marlon Maddox and a few of the others who are out there getting the information out, David Meyer. There are a lot of people who are trying to get the message out, and it's going to have a cumulative effect through the years.
Yes, I believe it will. And I'll be very honest, I acquired a lot of humility by being a talk show host, and I learned so much from my guests. By having such fine guests such as yourself and Charlotte Izzard-Beat and many others like Bernadine Smith, I have just opened my horizons basically on topics and dimensions which I was completely unaware of before.
Well, I think we all learn from our guests. I just did a program with John Loeffler just now, and I did a program earlier today with John McTernan, who wrote God's Final Warning, and then another program of the hour before that with Joel Skousen. So all of these people put in a lot of time and effort, and the information you glean from them helps you to get even a better insight into what's going on in our country today. And this is really what we're going to be talking about this evening, what's happening in America. And then, of course, John wanted to talk about what's happening as far as Asia is concerned, because the power in the world is shifting from the United States. We were at one time the leader nation in the world. At that time, we were one nation under God. Nobody would ever accuse us of being one nation under God today. And as the nation turns against God, why, God gradually withdraws his guidance from the nation, his support for the nation, his protection from the nation. And we're seeing increasingly the power beginning to shift to the Middle East. Yes, and even to Russia itself. And Russia is in full production for war. Just this last week, they've deployed another squadron of intercontinental nuclear-tipped missiles aimed at the United States. That's the fourth one they put into a position in this last year and a half or so. Russia is preparing for a nuclear war with the United States. And what are we doing? Why are we unilaterally disarming? We're building two ABM, anti-ballistic missile sites, so we will be able to actually field perhaps maybe 20 missiles that may or may not work against their incoming 700,000 nuclear-tipped missiles, because they haven't dismantled any of their missiles because they don't have any money to do it. We have enough money to dismantle ours, and instead of having a situation of mutual assured destruction, America is moving rapidly towards a condition where our policy will be based upon assured destruction. That is our assured destruction. So these are incredible times. We're doing everything we can to convince the communists that if they can strike at us with impunity, we've already said we will absorb the first strike. In other words, PDD 60, Presidential Decision Directive 60, yes, says that if there is a launch and we know the missiles are coming in, we will absorb the full impact of those incoming missiles. And then after we've absorbed the full impact, then we will retaliate if we have anything to retaliate with. You pick up the story from there, John. I know that you're very concerned about what's happening with Taiwan, the relationship between Communist China and Taiwan.
Yes, I am, Dr. Stan. But I became very concerned when George W. Bush decided that he should focus upon Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11, because I felt at that time that we were going to place ourselves in a vulnerable position in terms of being able to defend Taiwan. And, of course, what we have been doing is grinding down our armed forces, mainly in Iraq and to a lesser extent in Afghanistan. And I believe we have now just approximately one division deployed here in the United States. All of the other military divisions of the Army and Marines and related services are deployed overseas. And so we have very little to protect us here on the homeland front. And at the same time, we are wearing down our armed forces at such a rapid rate overseas that we are not going to be able to replace them unless we are to come up with some type of draft in the near future. And meanwhile, the Chinese leaders proclaimed nearly 2 years ago that they intend to have control of Taiwan by the year 2000. Now, these are not the words of John W. Spring or Dr. Stanley Monteith, but the words of none other than the leaders of China.
And no, you said by the year 2000. The year 2000 has already passed.
I'm sorry, the year 2005.
No, 2005.
By the year 2005, they intend to have control of Taiwan by whatever means is necessary. And they have been making provisions now for quite some time. They have been purchasing the Soviet aircraft with the latest advanced missiles. They have been purchasing former Soviet or Russian destroyers.
And submarines. They've got.
And also submarines. And basically, we have made no provisions to provide Taiwan with any type of defense against either a naval blockade or against missiles in such quantity being aimed at their island state.
Well, I think that the current Bush administration is intent upon betraying the people of Taiwan. In fact, they have recently warned Taiwan not to take a strong stand against reunification. So, you know, had the Democrats been in power and done this, it would have been an outcry. But as long as the Republicans are doing it, it's got to be all right. And because, of course, we have a one-party rule in Washington, D.C., there is no opposition effectively to George Bush. This is why we would have been so much better if Al Gore had been elected president, because the Republicans would have stood against his extremist policies. They would have objected to going to war with Iraq, and they would have objected to going into a war with Afghanistan and not even trying to get the wicked Osama bin Laden, because I think we would have had the attack, whether it had been the Bush or the whether it had been the Gore administration or the Bush administration in power. Osama bin Laden had announced he was going to attack us. They knew he was going to attack us. He started out in 1996 by putting out fatwas against us, and at each turn, we refused to do anything to try to stop him. including the Bush administration, refusing to do anything to try to stop Osama bin Laden from attacking America. But once he attacked, now we could justify going to war with Afghanistan so we could put the pipeline through, but never trying to intercept Osama bin Laden. And if you doubt that, we carry a book called Crude Politics. It's written by Paul Sperry, senior correspondent for the WorldNet Daily from Washington, D.C. Crude Politics tells the story of the Green Berets who were sent into Afghanistan and ordered not to try to get Osama bin Laden. We did not go there to try to get Osama bin Laden. We let him get away intentionally and purposely, and we've never tried to get him. And then, of course, after the Afghan war was over, instead of zeroing in and trying to stop international terrorism, what did we do? Well, we carried out the long-standing program to take over the Middle East, starting with Iraq. And if you doubt that is true, there's a wonderful book out. It's called Winning Modern Wars by a man named General Wesley Clark. And you can get the book, you can read it, where he talks about going, how Donald Rumsfeld, within hours of the September 11th attack, was saying, well, now can we go to war with Iraq? Can we go to war with Iraq now? And then by November, 2 months later, when General Clark goes to the Pentagon, he talks to one of the highest officials there who said, oh, yes, we've got a five-year program. We're going to attack Iraq and Lebanon and Syria and Iran and Sudan and Libya, and we're going to take them all out. That's the five-year plan. It was all in place. I mean, yes. The war is as phony as a $3 bill. The American people had to be convinced we had to go to war because Saddam was about to attack New York. And to protect New York from the attack from Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction, which we knew that he had. Why we went to war? Well, if he had those weapons, why didn't he use them against the American forces as they were advancing? Why didn't he use the chemical and biological weapons against our men? And it was because he never intended to use them at all. But then that's another story. So let's get back to your concerns, John, about what's happening in the Far East, because I think every American must understand that while we invest all of our wealth and our people, you know, in taking over the Middle East, and we have troops stationed all throughout the world, I think one of the next major world crisis areas will be in both Korea and, of course, the coming attack on Taiwan, and America will do everything they can to get the Taiwanese to give up their freedom and join together with the brutal regime in communist China.
First of all, we need to understand a little bit about Taiwan. Taiwan is sort of a legacy of former nationalist China, which originally was on the mainland, was the main legitimate government of China. It was based in Nanking rather than Beijing, as its national seat or capital. And in 1949, because General George Marshall and Secretary of State Dean Acheson had betrayed Chiang Kai-shek's regime, General Chiang's regime had to flee to Taiwan in 1949 to establish his government on the island of Formosa, which is now called Taiwan.
How did they betray Chiang Kai-shek? Would you want to cover that? Because I think that's so vitally important for people to understand.
Yes.
So we brought communism to China intentionally and purposely. How did we betray Chiang Kai-shek?
Well, we did this through many avenues, Dr. Stan. The one which is perhaps best known is that there were provisions purchased by General Chiang Kai-shek's Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's government well in advance. He had paid for them in full. These were mainly surplus rifles to a large extent, bolt-action rifles similar to the Springfield rifle of World War I vintage. The only problem was that the rifles were shipped, but without the bolts. And without the bolts, the weapons could not be fired. And those were held back. Some of the ammunition and other material did not reach its destination. And also there were attempts by the Americans through their Soviet contacts to support Mao Zedong's Red Army in China. And for the most part, behind the scenes,
the Truman administration under the auspices mainly of General George Marshall and Secretary of State Dean Acheson and people like Alger Hiss played a very significant role in betraying nationalist China.
And I really think that this was done intentionally because we did not want to have a powerful China to compete with us at that time. We wanted to bring the totalitarian regime to power. It was a social experiment, as David Rockefeller wrote in the New York Times in August of 1973 after returning from China, and they'd already by this time killed 60 to 80 million people. And David Rockefeller wrote, and you'll find the exact quotation in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, "The social experiment in China carried out under Chairman Mao is among the most important and significant in history." The social experiment in China under General under Chairman Mao is among the most important and significant in history. And it was simply a social experiment by the rulers of the world just to see what would happen when you imposed communism on this regime, because they recognized full well how industrious the Chinese people were. And if you had actually, of course, turned them loose and allowed them to have a representative government after the Second World War, they would have, of course, outproduced the United States at that time. They would have become the dominant power. And, of course, it wasn't time in 1945, 1950 period for that to occur. So we did everything we could to ensure that the nationalist Chinese would be defeated, that the communists would come to power, and we brought the communists to power. And now, of course, we're helping them to come to the fore. We're financing them. We're giving them every advantage. We're even going to turn over Taiwan to them. And the people who are working behind the scenes, I believe, intend to transfer America's wealth to communist China, and they will soon become the dominant force in the world.
Yes.
As long as we have traitors working in Washington, D.C., who have no loyalty to America but to this internationalist dream, then this process of treachery will continue.
Well, then there were two other things that happened. First of all, Taiwan became a very prosperous nation, one of the so-called economic tigers of the Orient, along with Singapore and South Korea, to mention a few others, as well as Japan, of course. And as a result of their very strong work ethic, they became one of the most prosperous nations in the world. We're speaking about Taiwan or the Republic of China, as it sometimes is also called. And as a result, it became so prosperous. So what do the people in Washington say about this? Well, we cannot allow this to continue, so we have to do something that will enable mainland China or communist China to become somewhat prosperous as well. So with the cooperation of the United States, the People's Republic of China designated areas along its coast known as special economic zones. Now, these SEZs were designed primarily to encourage large multinational corporations such as GE, General Motors, Ford, DuPont, whatever, to build factories, bring in technicians to train Chinese personnel how to operate and manufacture all of the processes. And that's as far as the Americans and foreigners were allowed to penetrate into China. It was a very restricted zone. The Chinese government was very selective in terms of which Chinese were allowed to enter into these areas. Obviously, these would be Chinese that would be very well trusted by the Beijing regime. And, of course, the Americans and foreigners could not travel beyond those special economic zones without special permits and escorted guides, for the most part. And for some reason, there are Americans and well-wishers throughout the world that believe by having these special economic zones that we are going to somehow influence China into becoming a more democratic nation.
It's like feeding a tiger meat hoping he's going to become a vegetarian. It
absolutely
really doesn't work.
And unfortunately, this has not worked. But getting back to Taiwan, Taiwan has become a very prosperous nation. A good share of the electronic components found in many of your household appliances, such as computers and televisions and radios and various sophisticated equipment that you might find at the workplace. Many of these components are manufactured in Taiwan, as well as other parts of the Orient as well nowadays. But what is unique about Taiwan is that you have a very highly skilled and very well-educated labor force. It has a population of about 22 million people, but Taiwan has evolved into a free representative republic. It is probably one of the few free nations in the Western Pacific or East Asian realm, and unfortunately, because it has tried so hard to become what we would refer to through the news media as a democratic nation, we are penalizing it as such, and we now are saying to Taiwan, basically, and this has been true for about the last two decades, you are no longer really a nation. The People's Republic of China is now the legitimate China. There's not a two-China policy. You no longer have your vote on the Security Council. In fact, you're not even going to be a member of the United Nations anymore. That right now goes to the Beijing regime of the People's Republic of China. And you are not even going to be recognized as an official state or nation. We will send a consulate general over there, but we will not recognize you with the same diplomatic status as we would provide to other nations throughout the world.
Of course, we can thank Richard Nixon for that. That goes back to the Nixon time.
Absolutely.
When he gave Taiwan's seat on the United Nations to Communist China.
So here we are in a situation which is possibly less than a year from now, whereby the People's Republic of China intend to have control of that island nation of Taiwan if they so much as declare their own independence, or if that doesn't work out, then they will just simply establish a blockade around that island nation, and after a few months without food from outside sources and the necessary raw materials to remain a viable economy, it's very possible that Taiwan would be almost forced to capitulate.
Well, I think that this is the current plan of our current administration. And as I say, if the Democrats were in power, there would be an outcry from the Republicans. With the Republicans in power, why, the Republican legislature will go right along with it, because after all, if the Republicans are going to betray Taiwan, that's all right. It's only bad if the Democrats betray Taiwan. It's about time we understand we have bipartisan treason, and so often the major strides of international communism are made not under the Democrats, but under the Republicans.
Yes, and we need to also understand that because so much of the policy has been established by the Department of State, which is infested with Council on Foreign Relations members and staff, that, for example, we cannot provide China with any modern submarines that could be very useful against the naval blockade. They have basically obsolete World War II vintage submarines, which are completely ineffective, belong in a museum now, or to be scrapped. And by contrast, mainland China, or the People's Republic of China, is purchasing the most advanced submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, from the former Soviet Union, or Russia. And the same is true with other types of material. The latest aircraft, as I mentioned earlier, the latest missiles, which they are either building themselves with U.S. technology or purchasing from the Russians and elsewhere. And the problem is, Dr. Stan, that we need to contact our congressmen and women, and also our senators and the senators and congressmen of other states, and make them aware of the crucial situation, because as I said earlier, this is not something that you or I have stated. This is something that has been stated very clearly by the leaders in Beijing. They are making the proclamation that basically they will be in control of Taiwan by the year 2005. Now, they are prepared to carry out a military invasion, and they've been making provisions for that And unless we provide assistance, it's going to be rather futile.
Well, I think that the tragedy is right now, John, that we are being manipulated. Our attention is being focused on what's going on in the Near East, what's going on in Iraq, where American boys, almost one a day, is being killed now, and how many are being wounded and will carry the pain of their wounds and disability for the rest of their lives. And between the attention on Iraq, the attention on what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict,
yes,
very little is being done to focus our attention on this very real threat from that exists in the Far East, and even less attention is being placed on the threat of a nuclear attack on the United States by our good friends over in Russia, who are in full military production for war. And they're developing new intercontinental ballistic missiles, far more accurate, far more dangerous, far more powerful than anything we have. And they have over 7,000 warheads. And America is unilaterally disarming. What's wrong with this picture? Unless, if you look at it with an understanding that there are spiritual forces behind everything that's going on. And if you're looking at it from a point of view of logic, there isn't any. If you're looking at it from a point of view of the fact that God has a plan, and that Lucifer has a plan, and those plans are being implemented today, then, of course, you can understand why America may very well suffer horrible, horrible losses when we, according to Presidential Decision Directive 60, and you can pull that down on the Internet, and it will tell you that the plan is that we will absorb the first strike. We will retaliate after that, if we have anything to retaliate with. Of course, we might also be given an offer, that if you do retaliate against Russia, then we will come back again and wipe out every one of your cities. At that point, what would our leaders do? Would they sacrifice every major city in America for the satisfaction of killing a few million Russians? Because they have a system of civilian defense. They can protect their population.
Yes, they
can.
We
have no defense for the American people.
We never have made those provisions. We've just been buying into the previous doctrine of mutually assured destruction.
Well, what now the project or the policy is not mutually assured destruction, but simply assured destruction,
Absolutely. The
assured destruction of the United States. And this is never talked about here in the United States. And we never ask why we have no effective anti-ballistic missile system defense when we knew how to create one in the early 1970s, but we don't know how to create one in year 2003. Something's wrong with this story.
Yes. And in reality, even back then, Dr. Stan, when they said we had a policy of mutually assured destruction, we did not. The Soviets were investing billions of dollars on a civil defense system whereby they would have underground shelters and bunkers for their civilian population as well as their military personnel. And unfortunately, we have never made any provisions to protect our people. And yet, I think it says in the preamble of our Constitution to provide for the common defense, and our leaders have been very negligent in that aspect in recent decades.
Well, of course, they have a different agenda. And there's all the reasons that are given why we can't have any sort of a defense for America. And as I pointed out, in 1970, we began developing an anti-ballistic missile system. They were armed with, of course, low-yield nuclear weapons that were on each one of the interceptor missiles, so that they would explode something in the proximity to an incoming missile and would knock out the electronics on all the other missiles that they had and would destroy the missiles. This is what the Russians put on their interceptors. This is what we had in ours. And they worked, and they worked very efficiently.
Yes.
And then, of course, they did away with that. They said, oh, we wouldn't want to do anything like that. We've got to hit a bullet with a bullet, but we don't know how. And so we dismantled the effective anti-ballistic missile system we had in the 1970s and under the regime of Jimmy Carter, because it was just too expensive. It would cost us about $4 billion to have maintained it. And so we're going to expend hundreds of billions of dollars on research on a program that is not going to work. And the only reason I can explain that this is happening is there are people who, whether they know it or not, are laying open America for a horrible, horrible nuclear exchange. World War III is upon us, and the average American has no idea what's happening. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs if you believe there's a problem out there. If you'd like to be part of a ministry that is doing something positive, and I should point out that although we are a ministry, we're not a tax-exempt ministry, because we want to be able to tell you the truth, and if we were to speak the way we do, why, of course, the IRS would be down on top of us. You're not supposed to tell the truth, and if you do, why, you'll lose your tax-exempt status. So we have nothing to lose. We do not have a tax-exempt status, and if you contribute to Radio Liberty, you do so because you believe in what we're doing, not because you want to win favors with the IRS. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, if you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, which incidentally deals with the true story of Judge Roy Moore, why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools, and what you must do to understand that we're involved in this spiritual battle, and the battle that Roy Moore is engaged in is part of that battle. If you'd like a copy of that December newsletter, you'll have to call 1-800-544-8927 and specifically request the December newsletter, and we'll get it off to you just as soon as it's ready, comes off the press, hopefully the first of the week, but you'll have to specify which one you want. And then, of course, if you'd like to learn more about our ministry, why you can go to our website at www.radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs live 5 hours a day, probably recorded on our from our archives another 5 hours a day, and you certainly won't get anything accomplished, but you'll get a lot of education, a lot of facts, and then you'll know where to go to verify if what we're saying is true, because if what we're saying is not true, you can go on and you can live the good life, but if what we're saying is true, then I believe you have a moral obligation to join in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, because if you don't involve, who will be, and if not now, when? I believe we all have an obligation to try to preserve the freedom that we inherited from generations past, so we can transmit this to generations yet unborn. So find out if what we're saying is true. The simplest thing, are we a republic or democracy? Everybody knows we're a democracy, but is that really true? Or have we been lied to at every turn? Read the Federalist Papers, the 10th of the Federalist Papers by James Madison. Read the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and see if you can ever find the use of the word democracy other than to decry its use. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is John Spring, and he's talking about the coming crisis in the Middle East, and of course they're not focusing our attention on that. They're focusing our attention through the controlled media on what's happening in the Middle East, on the threat of terrorism, and there's going to be a terrorist attack on America at any time, and we know that because we're picking up the chatter, and the Arabs have been told, in fact we've read this, that the Muslims have been told to evacuate New York and Washington, D.C., and the city of Los Angeles, and this is coming out on the Arab television and being circulated in America. The question is, if nothing happens, will the Arabs evacuate next time they're being told there's a problem? Well, I think that we're being manipulated. I think that the Muslims in this country is being manipulated. I think a reality is controlled by those who control television and radio and publishing here in America. We've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. Just want to ask a question. First, I have to give a little background. You know, a few weeks ago, Halliburton was heating up as a really big story in the news, and then all of a sudden, we supposedly captured Saddam Hussein, and lo and behold, Halliburton disappears from the news, and It just seems like the whole storyline regarding Saddam Hussein seems to have come and gone so quickly, and I've just had a heck of a time trying, actually, you know, believing that they really caught him.
I think you brought up a good point, Mike. I have my serious doubts about it as well. Remember, Saddam Hussein was a person of at least 6-plus feet in stature and spoke very good English, and I'm surprised that they have not allowed him to speak any English, making even bizarre statements in the English language, which he spoke almost fluently. So you've brought up a very good point there. And yes, it's very possible that an event of this type could be to cover up something such as Halliburton. That's a very astute point you've made.
Well, I think another point, Mike, was that they also, it was that same weekend that Saddam Hussein was captured on the 13th of September, that the president signed the Patriot II Act, massively increasing the power of the Federal Bureau of Investigation to violate the various parts of our Constitution. That was almost mentioned without, it just wasn't mentioned at all. The story was drowned out, as so many important stories are, by the capture of the wicked Saddam Hussein.
Yes, and then, of course, earlier in the week, our president makes a statement regarding Taiwan being warned not to declare its independence when the leader of China is visiting with him in Washington. So you begin to wonder what's really going on.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to tell us. Might as well just go fishing, I think.
Well, that's why we do what we do, as you know, Mike, trying to get people to think. And there's a growing audience out there that are listening to our programs and at least are beginning to question the way that we are manipulated by the controlled media.
Yep. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, so much, Mike. And our telephone number is 464-8295 or out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is John Spring, and he's talking about his concern over the coming confrontation over Taiwan. Go ahead, John.
Well, Dr. Stan, you brought up some very good points about Russia, and during the Cold War, for example, a lot of things went on that we simply ignored. We're all aware of the engineering project at Bratsk Dam, making it at that time the largest dam of its kind in the world, and it was located in very close proximity, just a few hundred miles east of a place known as Khabarovsk. And at Khabarovsk, they had one of the largest radar systems in the world, built primarily for an anti-defense missile system. But they were allowed to keep that under the MAT agreement, when in reality, if we were to keep such an agreement, that should have been done away with. But, of course, we were not concerned about protecting our own people. We were mainly concerned about placating the Soviets and other leaders throughout the world so that supposedly it would not become a hot war during that time era. But you are right. We basically were unilaterally disarming then, as we are even right now. And it's very unfortunate, because this is another factor that we're going to have to contend with if and when North Korea strikes South Korea and mainland China strikes at Taiwan.
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things, John, is you wonder how gullible the American people really are. Who is keeping Kim Il-sung's son in power there? Why, we are. We're supplying food for the North Koreans. Oh, we've got to supply food. People are starving there. Well, food is not really going to the starving people. It's going to the military, because if you don't feed the military, they overthrow the government. So we are keeping him in power. We've been supplying oil there for their electric generators. We're helping them build a nuclear generator. We've been doing everything we can to keep the wicked dictator of North Korea in power, as we do with dictators all throughout the world, but we always do it under one guise or another. Oh, it's humanitarian aid. It's like the humanitarian aid we gave to the Taliban right up until September of the year 2001. We backed the Taliban at every turn, all the time that they were having their terrible policies towards women and oppressing women's rights and cutting off people's hands and feet and stoning women for caught in adultery and forcing them to wear the burqa or whatever you call it. But You know, then we say, oh, these terrible Taliban, we've just got to take them out, we've got to kill them off now. And we had been backing and financing the Mullah Omar. But the average individual cannot imagine anything this diabolical, because why would you say one thing and then do another? We are keeping dictators in power all throughout the world today. And it's about time you realize where your tax money is going, and at least you have an obligation to be involved in the process. You're paying your taxes, then you have an obligation to be involved in knowing where it's going, and, of course, being able to actively object to most of the policies as America imposes its Pax Americana throughout the world, and we keep dictators. It doesn't matter whether they're in Africa or in the middle of Asia, where we're backing the communist dictators in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and you name all these countries, and we're maintaining an authoritarian structure in Afghanistan. We're going to impose another form of authoritarian structure, certainly in Iraq. We're maintaining the dictatorship in Georgia. Now they've gotten Shevardnadze out of there, and we've replaced him. Probably there'll be another dictator coming in. Why? Because there's a pipeline going to go through there, a very important pipeline going through Georgia. We're going to be carrying oil over into the towards Europe. And this is really what it's all about. But we can't let the American people know that we would finance dictators because as long as they're willing to go along with our foreign policy, where we're going to get their trouble right now is in Pakistan. There have been two attempts on the life of Musharraf there, of the dictator we're keeping in power. The puppet that we have in Pakistan and the radical Islamists are intent upon overthrowing him. And when they do, if they kill him, they're going to have the nuclear bomb, ladies and gentlemen. They're going to have thermonuclear weapons that can be used against America. And that is where we really ought to be putting our attention right now. Pakistan has the bomb. They're going to kill Musharraf. And then what do you think is going to happen in the Middle East and here in the United States?
Well, very shortly thereafter, Iran's also going to get the nuclear bomb. But if I may digress for just a moment to Kazakhstan, which you mentioned a moment ago, we have to understand that this is the portion of the region known as the Aral-Caspian Basin, which is very rich in terms of petroleum and natural gas resources. And currently, we need to remind our listening audience that there is a pipeline built through the auspices of many multinational corporations such as British Petroleum and Chevron that is going to go across the steppes of Central Asia to China proper itself, and they may very well have this pipeline operational before an invasion of Taiwan takes place by the year 2005.
Well, they'll need all that oil to maintain their military so that they can kill the Taiwanese, and we'll provide them with the oil for it.
Absolutely. And, of course, we again need to remind our audience that a pipeline is being proposed through western Afghanistan, and this is primarily the reason why we are occupying Afghanistan, not to fight terrorists such as the Taliban or Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda group, but rather to see that this pipeline is constructed basically from Turkmenistan or Turkestan through western Afghanistan to the west coast of Pakistan, to the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. So, for all intents and purposes, there is very little to do about fighting for freedom or fighting against terrorism, but rather it is to take care of the multinational oil interests concerns. And also, what concerns me is that in both nations, I see a Marxist element that's developing. Now, as Mike pointed out regarding the alleged or supposed capture of Saddam Hussein, that that very same day, early in the morning, before they just edited out some of the details, I saw many red banners being carried by Marxists and communists throughout the streets that had the white emblem of the hammer and sickle on them, and Marxist slogans written in Arabic,
And for some reason, there wasn't one single news correspondent who made any comment about that. And you begin to wonder what type of a government we're planning to install in Baghdad in the near future.
Well, of course, we know that with the government that we've installed in Afghanistan, we have, of course, Karzai, who's the puppet figurehead, but the real power in the Afghan government comes from this gentleman who from the Northern Alliance, who you know so well, and he is a hardline Marxist. So what we've really done, if the truth ought to be known, is to put in a reliable communist government there in Afghanistan. But we can't let the American people know that. They might wonder what this is really all about. What they really they cannot understand is we install communist governments throughout the world. We're doing this in Rhodesia. We did this in South Africa. We did it in Southwest Africa. This is what they're trying to do in the Congo. We've already done that in Angola. It's so interesting, John, that
yes.
We're reading now that the FBI is tracking the anti-war demonstrators, and they're taking records on the anti-war demonstrators and who's attending these, because we're concerned that there may be anarchists in the audience. That, of course, is a lie. The FBI knows that the people who are organizing the anti-war demonstrations are one of the major forces behind that here in the United States and throughout the world are the communists. And they're mobilizing these marches, such as we had the battle in Seattle, the demonstrations against globalization, the World Bank meetings, and other similar international meetings. The FBI knows that communism is alive and well, but we can't tell that to the American people, because we've been told over and over again that communism is dead.
Yes.
But, of course, what we never will tell us is who finances communism, and so much of that money has come from the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and they're the people who are putting up a lot of the money for what's going on today, just as the United States and our corporations are putting up so much of the money for what's happening in communist China and in Russia today.
Yes.
We can never let the American people know that we create the best enemies money can buy. And for our listeners, if you haven't seen the video, my interview with Professor Sutton on that subject, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, you should see it, or read his book, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, because that's what it's all about. You create your enemy, and then you set out to destroy them, and in the process, you take away the freedom of your subjects.
I just thought I might digress a moment back to Afghanistan. The leader that we're talking about is General Muhammad Fahim. Now, Fahim was one of the Marxists who came to power during the communist coup or takeover back in 1978. That's when the communists took control of the Kabul government, which was a freely elected representative type of government with basically a constitutional monarchy at that time. The constitution was signed in 1965 by various dignitaries throughout Afghanistan. And by force, the communists took over and established their own government, and all of these government officials were either killed or forced into exile. And the person who's now really running the show in Afghanistan is none other than General Muhammad Fahim, who's Minister of Defense. And while our puppet Hamid Karzai is meeting with foreigners and ignoring the Afghan people himself, it is General Fahim who is making sure that his troops, his own private army, and the directives that he gives to the NATO forces there are carrying out his directives, which will enable him to get rid of, if he so chooses, former patriotic Mujahideen, or the Afghan freedom fighters who fought against the Soviets when, of course, he was himself fighting with the Soviets, along with Dostum, who fought with the Soviets in the early years of that war against Soviet forces.
In other words, 25 years ago, Fahim was there fighting for the communists, and then, of course, we set up this Afghan war, and we spend billions of dollars to drive the Soviets out, and then we bring them back into power. What's wrong with this picture? An awful lot of people died in wars that were fought for no reason at all, because we never intended to get the communists out of Afghanistan. In fact, we brought them back in. And Fahim, who was there fighting with the communists 25 years ago, is now there with our blessing.
And if the And if the truth were completely known, the plans were underway before 9/11 for us to go into Afghanistan. We were already negotiating. We already had some small contingent forces deployed in Central Asia for that main reason, to invade Afghanistan. But, of course, we needed to have a legitimate reason to gain the approval of the American people, and 9/11 gave us that reason.
And this, of course, is what the average American does not understand. There were actually conversations months beforehand. The question was Osama bin Laden going to attack America first, or was America going to attack Osama bin Laden first? We carry a book written by a French newspaper, by a French author, which actually quotes the former head of the former foreign minister of Afghanistan, saying it attended a meeting with the Americans where the statement was made. I'm sorry, he was the foreign minister of Pakistan, attended a meeting in July of the year 2001, where, of course, the statement was made that America will either pave the streets of Afghanistan with gold or with carpet bombs, one way or the other. And if they won't go along with our building the pipeline, then we will, of course, pave their streets with carpet bombs, which is exactly what we did. The plan was already there. If you've read the PNAC report on their website, newamericancentury.org, you'll find that in 1998, we were already planning on going to war with Iraq. And everything since then has simply been, how are we going to get the suckers in America to go along with it? If you read their report from PNAC, it's on their website at newamericancentury.org. It's the Rebuilding America's Defenses report. They said we're never going to be able to put this over, get this established, unless there is a catastrophic and cataclysmic event like another Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, we'll be able to go ahead with what we want. It's all there in their report. You can get that from my newsletters, find out where to look in their material. So we had a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor on September 11th, 2001.
And we should also mention, Dr. Stan, that prior to 9/11, Hamid Karzai was working as a negotiator on behalf of UNICAL to negotiate with the Taliban, hopefully, for a pipeline route to go through western Afghanistan. Of course, he was unable to negotiate with the Taliban, but this is why we decided to make him our leader in Afghanistan.
You know, if anybody thinks that there's any relationship between what's going on and big corporations, let's just point out that, of course, here's Karzai working for UNICAL. Condoleezza Rice, a consultant for a Chevron Oil Company. In fact, they even named a tanker after her. Of course, they changed his name after she became the foreign policy advisor to the President of the United States. We find Dick Cheney, having spent his whole life in government, leaves government in 1992 to become the CEO of Halliburton. And then, of course, he comes back into government as vice president, continues to receive a delayed salary of $100,000 a year, and Halliburton gets all of these contracts without any bid at all. And then we find out that they're overcharging the American government for gasoline, and they say, well, shucks, wasn't our fault. We were under pressure to do what we did. And then Bechtel's over there getting great big contracts, no-bid contracts. And who does Bechtel represent? Why, people like George Shultz, who's on the board of directors of that corporation. So, really, these people give incest and corruption a bad name.
Yes, and unfortunately, many of our former officials, such as Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig and the first President George Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, are basically lobbyists on behalf of China. And so you get an idea as to why it's very difficult for the American people to really become informed as to what is transpiring over in China with respect to Taiwan's peril. And I just hope and pray that everyone who's listening tonight will heed my plea to, first of all, go to my website, which is worldstrategy.netfirms.com, and after you go through the pages and come to my article, which starts out with basically news of Asia, the Pacific Rim, and the world, when you read through those five or six pages, depending on the format of your particular monitor, then write a letter to your congressmen and senators so that hopefully we can turn the situation around very quickly with at least some support from Washington, because so much is happening over there in the Far East which most Americans are unaware of. For example, Dr. Stan, I'm sure you're aware of this, but I doubt if many in the listening audience are aware that between 15,000 to 30,000 troops who are deployed in South Korea, American troops, are being redeployed to Afghanistan and Iraq, making South Korea a little bit more vulnerable than it was previously. And at the same time, we are doing very little to provide for Taiwan's defense. We are not providing them with any Aegis-class destroyers. We're not providing them with any modern submarines.
Add ballistic missiles, which is what they really need, an add ballistic missile system that will work, and we're not allowing them to have one that's really effective.
No.
Now, tell me, let's get your website one more time there, John.
Okay, Dr. Stan, it's www.worldstrategy, that's one word, .netfirms, there's an S.
Netfirms?
Yes, there's an S at the end, .com.
All right, fine.
And if they go to worldstrategy.netfirms.com, they will read this article about China and Taiwan, as well as some other articles related to the Middle East and elsewhere. But focus primarily on this one related to China and Taiwan. Although it was written 2 years ago, it is just as timely. In fact, it's more timely now than it was at the time that it was written, because nothing basically has changed. The situation has just worsened.
Well, nothing that goes on today makes any sense unless you understand that there are spiritual forces behind this, that there is a dark game being played out in another battlefield in another dimension. And we're going to have, one of these days, we're going to have to face the fact that we truly are involved in a spiritual battle. And our job is to stand for righteousness and to look to the Lord for help. John, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, again, I would say that we need to become very much aware of the situation in Taiwan, because there's far more at stake than just Taiwan itself. There's other neighboring nations, of course, like Japan and South Korea, but there's also the Philippines, there's Singapore, there's Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand, and yes, even eventually the United States. And if we neglect Taiwan, eventually we're going to have to face the fact that there's no other nation to turn to for help, and we're going to have to deal with Communist China ourselves sooner or later. So I hope and pray that we become aware of the situation now, while we are still in a position to do something about it without heavy bloodshed, because I assure you that if we ignore the situation much longer, it will possibly be the end of the United States.
And what is it? Those who won't say no on their standing on their feet will may one day say yes on bended knee. God bless you for being with us, John. It's always a pleasure having you with us. And thank you so much. Have a wonderful what's left of the holiday season. We'll be talking to you after, of course, the new year.
Lord bless you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. And our guest has been John Spring. And I hope you've enjoyed this. Of course, we'll be with you then again on Monday evening and leading up to the new year. These are exciting times to know the Lord, because without a knowledge of Him, why, of course, would be frightened to death knowing what we know about the rapid move of this country towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. And so until Monday, we'll be back again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.